World with Reporters.
As the fasting month of Ramadan arrives, Afghans happily welcome it with honor and pride. In the meantime, poverty and low control over prices in the market by the government are major problems that poor families are facing. That is why they call on responsible bodies to take strict measures in order to control the market during the holy month.
We want businesses to think about difficulties of the poor during the fasting month of Ramadan. Government bodies also need to fully control food prices and prevent sharp price hikes during Ramadan to help poor families and individuals.
Fasting Afghans also see this month as an opportunity for not only strengthen their bonds with God, but also to further help and support the underprivileged in society. That is one of the fundamental teachings of Islam.
This is a religious and humanitarian responsibility of every single Muslim to help poor people, especially orphans and widows who have no breadwinner, and Ramadan creates opportunities for us to fulfill our responsibility in this regard.
Besides other challenges, the COVID-19 pandemic in Afghanistan is also a problem on the way of fasting Afghans. This is because they religiously organize big gatherings during the holy month each year.
The continuation of terrorist attacks and bombings during the fasting month of Ramadan is one of the other headaches for Afghans, especially for military forces who are either in the front lines or inside their posts and bases across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi announces Iran's decision to increase the level of uranium enrichment from 20 to 60% and to install an additional 1,000 centrifuges at its Natanz facility, the target of a recent act of sabotage. Araghchi broke the news upon arriving in Vienna for another joint commission meeting aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. He said the International Atomic Energy Agency has been informed.
We just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%. And that is for Iran needs in to produce certain radio isotopes needed for certain medical treatments.
Araghchi said the damaged centrifuges in Natanz would be replaced by more advanced ones, and that things would go back to normal there in the coming weeks. Signatories of the nuclear deal are expected to meet in Vienna on Thursday as negotiations continue. Iran insists that all US sanctions should be lifted and their removal verified before it goes back to full compliance.
We believe that this round of negotiations is the time for the US to present the list. And I hope that I can go back to Tehran with the list of sanctions which should be lifted. Otherwise, I don't believe we can continue like this. Otherwise, it would be a waste of time, actually. So let's see.
Informal discussions have already begun here with the hope of reaching an agreement on the list of US sanctions that need to be lifted, after which Iran says it will discuss the verification process. Homaleski, Vienna.
Lining up for donated clothes and a warm meal. More than 100 men who have survived Western-backed wars in the Middle East and Africa and a death-defying journey to get to the UK. A former bank employee, Keenan, is a Syrian asylum seeker living in temporary accommodation in the Welsh city of Cardiff.
I didn't leave my country in the first 5 years of the war. I left after 8 years and a half. I tried and did my level best to stay in my home country and not being a refugee. Refugee is not a good thing to be. It's not an option.
Before Cardiff, this father of one and his fellow asylum seekers had been housed in a dilapidated army barracks in the coastal village of Penali. Economics graduate Fateh worked as a risk analyst in his home country.
When I first came here, I had no idea about military camps, but we put into camps and it was a horrible experience.
The UK government says it takes the well-being of asylum seekers extremely seriously, and any abuse is completely unacceptable. But the organizer of the welcoming event in Cardiff, who has also spent a lifetime combating racism, believes the government has failed to live up to its obligation.
Without a shadow of a doubt, they failed. They failed miserably. Some of the initial accommodation is abysmal. We have seen people rehoused in shared houses where they have to share one bathroom, one kitchen, with dangerous kitchen facilities.
After surviving the dangerous journey to Europe, they were greeted with this: far-right protests in Dover last year.
Here in Cardiff today, an act of kindness and compassion towards asylum seekers who come here from far and wide, from the Middle East and Africa, among them doctors and engineers. Contrast this with the kind of hostility and hate they have been receiving from some people who think that their country is under invasion by irregular immigrants.
One of the consequences of coronavirus has meant the country's already overloaded asylum application system has ground to a halt, leaving these men living a life of wait and see.
Many people have been living here in limbo, not knowing when their asylum process is going to be progressed. And of course you have some people here who are separated from their family. They have family.
Britain remains the fifth most favorite European destination for refugees and asylum seekers, way behind Germany, France, Spain, and Greece. Kenan and other refugees and asylum seekers have survived war and the perilous voyage here, but their journey to call it their new home is yet to end. Saeed Pourreza, London.
While millions of Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's continued seizure of oil ships, an Emirati oil tanker named Saga has arrived at Bir Ali port in Shabwa in eastern Yemen to transport 115,000 tons of Yemeni crude oil to the UAE.
Oil smuggling carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in southern and eastern provinces has cost Yemen more than $7 billion over the past 2 years. Annually, more than 14 million barrels of crude oil are being smuggled illegally through several ports in Shabwa province, which is under the control of Saudi Arabia.
Meanwhile, Yemen's petroleum company says another oil tanker named Apollitaris is on its way to Deva port in Al Mukalla to move more than 300,000 tons of oil to an unknown destination.
Yemen is being systematically plundered by Saudi Arabia. An estimated $145 million of oil income is being looted monthly. Recently, an Emirati ship arrived at Shabwa port to plunder 1 million barrels of crude oil, and there is another ship coming from China to transport over 2 million barrels of crude oil.
Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued detention of 10 patrol ships by Saudi Arabia, while the vessels are inspected and authorized by the UN through verification and inspection mechanism.
Yemenis say plundering their oil is an illegal act that reveals the real reasons for the years-long war on their country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was a pitch battle in garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistan's capital Islamabad. The violent clashes erupted after what protesters blamed the government to have backed out of its agreement with them to expel the French ambassador to Pakistan over the repeated incidents of public display and republication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Many died and dozens of others injured from the both sides in the clashes after the protesters blocked the major railways and road links. Protesters claimed that at least 10 of their companions were killed and over 100 were arrested by the police.
This government doesn't care about the dignity of our prophet. Obviously, people take to the streets to show their anger. We gave the government 5 months to expel the French ambassador, but they did not expel him. we will continue our protests until our demand is met, which is the expulsion of French ambassador.
Pakistan has a history of similar violent protests over the frequent incidents of blasphemy of the Prophet under the guise of freedom of expression in the West. Protecting the honor of the Prophet is the most sensitive issue in Pakistan, which attracted millions of people on the roads in the past.
Sending the French ambassador back may be a kind of a step which again could provide an immediate relief as far as the domestic political scene is concerned, but that is not going to solve the problem. Today it is France, tomorrow it will be another country, and so we need to be having a comprehensive campaign.
Pakistan has been under pressure from Paris-based anti-money laundering outfit, the Financial Action Task Force, which placed Pakistan on grey list a few years ago on the charges of terror financing. Now Pakistan needs French support together with other countries to come out of the grey list, because of which Islamabad is reluctant to expel French ambassador. However, rising anti-French sentiments in Pakistan are leaving little option with the government but to expel French ambassador. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Restaurateurs, gym owners and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome. Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom and let us get back to work," with some hurling smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings.
The protest turned nasty when protesters infiltrated by alt-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon.
The government keeps ignoring us. My shop has been closed since October, but the rent and all bills must be paid anyway. How can we continue this way? I am afraid some people will resort to extreme acts.
Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after six regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign. Max Civili, Rome.
Increasing the number of...
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Rycroft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a prime minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations' devolved governments are essentially self-governing. This has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, the UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England only. He doesn't seem to care about the Union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved governments and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions, with Rife Cuff claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag-waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbella, London.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the US-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
The Ramadan crescent moon has been sighted in Iran, and this means the fasting month begins on Wednesday. During the holy month, Muslims abstain from eating and drinking from dawn to dusk as a means to practice self-restraint. In Iran, restaurants close during the day and instead work longer hours overnight. This is especially the case for confectionaries, where they add these special sweets to their shelves. Every year in Ramadan,
Iranians usually break their fast by eating sweet and energetic foods. So every year in Ramadan, we bake Zulbiyan baklava because they refresh the body after hours of fasting. You can find them in every Iranian confectionery during Ramadan.
This is the second year in a row that Muslims observe the fasting month amid the coronavirus pandemic. With Iran now under a partial nationwide lockdown, religious authorities have ordered that all mass religious ceremonies be either cancelled or held in open-air environments with social distancing.
I pray to God to help us overcome the coronavirus. Unfortunately, this year, as in the previous Ramadan, the pandemic has kept us from gathering together to practice the Ramadan rituals.
Ramadan has always been a chance to take part in charity works, and now that the pandemic has unemployed many people, Muslims feel bound to rush for help.
During Ramadan, charity institutes ramp up their activities. This year, many people have lost their income as a result of the pandemic, so more families depend on donations to be able to break their fast.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the lunar calendar, where months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the Earth. At the start of each month, depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Some Muslim nations, such as Iraq and Lebanon, started the fasting month a day ahead of Iran.
To Muslims, Ramadan is more than just a time to abstain from eating and drinking. They find it an opportunity to purify the soul from materialistic desires and polish it with spirituality. This year, they use the occasion as a chance to ask God to make it the last Ramadan that is marked with the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining me and my wonderful guests on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor and pleasure of having my brothers in faith and humanity join us on today's interesting discussion. To my left, I have the one and only. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Sister Zainab, again, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure
thank
to be with you.
Thank you for joining us, bro.
My name is Brother Yasser. I'm from South Africa.
MashaAllah.
I've been here too long. Hope to benefit.
What are you doing here? Why have you been here for so long?
I've been studying in the Islamic seminary for the last 11 years. I'm just finishing my master's.
May Allah increase your tawfiq and prolong Inshallah. Your life. And to my right, I have my special brother and guest. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us.
This is Ayman Rizvi, and I am actually in the Hawza as well for mm-hmm. about 7 to 8 years.
MashaAllah.
Finishing up my second master's program here.
Today we're going to be discussing a very interesting topic, negotiating with people. I really can't be bothered under normal circumstances. I'm like, this is red. And the other person is like, no, it's blue. And I'm like, yeah, I love blue. Blue's a good color. Blue looks good on this item. It's blue now. Alrighty then, have a nice day. Brother Yasser, you look like the kind of individual who'd have to get himself into a lot of situations where negotiation was required. See that heavy breathing right there? That says a lot. Volumes of books right there.
Like
intensity intensifies.
Look, for example, right, in life, you have certain negotiation might not be a good word. Like you come into have a discussion or you come to immutable agreement. That's a better word to put.
Oh, let's agree to disagree like that?
Something like that.
Oh, how bigger person of you.
Yeah, you see, in that type of sense. Because...
How often does that happen to you?
In my home all the time. It's not that. It's like, for example, like at home, alhamdulillah, you know, you have kids and you have your family, your wife and so on and so forth. So, you know, always the case that, you know, that you and your kids will agree on something or you and your wife will agree on something. So you have to come to a consensus or a type of middle ground,
yeah,
so to speak, especially in the family. This is very important because obviously the husband is from a certain background, has certain ideas. It's, you know, you're not the same people. Yes, you're living under the same roof.
I mean, even with your siblings, you don't feel like that.
Exactly. Like me and my brothers, for example, you know, we have different likes, different dislikes, and so on. So, you know, if he wants to do something, fine, whatever. You know, it's not up to me to force you. Exactly. I'm not going to force you to do something. That's with them. Like, but for example, for children and so on, yes, there is a point where you have to kind of discipline and so on. That's different, right? This negotiation or this debate and discussion obviously has different dimensions depending on who you're talking to.
Are you saying that there are situations where you don't even have to discuss?
Exactly. When your wife tells you something, you don't discuss. You just say, yeah, done it. You go.
You are officially my hero, my role model. The society looks up to you. We need more men like this in the world. It would be a merrier place. You, good sir, deserve an award.
Like, even I remember when I was going back to South Africa once for one of my brother's weddings. Because I have a lot of...
How many brothers do you have?
We have five brothers.
Mashallah.
I'm the eldest of five.
Allah, Allah.
So I have a teacher who's... Alhamdulillah, may Allah bless him. You know, he helped out a lot in this regard. Because I have a lot of family members who are not Shi'i. They're Muslim, but they're Sunni Muslims.
Cool.
So I would speak to this teacher, and he would say, like, look, this is the situation, you know, going back, what do we do? And I realized that, you know, there are so many other things that you can talk about that will not bring up a heated debate. One of the things that he always recommended is, like, don't discuss religion with people who do not want to discuss it.
Absolutely.
Always wait, for example, for them to ask a particular question. Even then, if it's a sensitive question, refrain from answering until you are forced to answer.
Wow.
So it was like the advice that he gave, and it's kind of, you know, focused what you need to do.
And your energy, good God. Because that could have been such a joyous occasion if you were one of those people who wanted to be like left, right, and center. Oh, no, but that's haram. Oh, no, but that's not how you do it. Oh, no, but your ideology is entirely wrong. You know? You would have ruined the wedding.
Yeah, so... And not only that, you there's one of the things that you have, that a holier-than-thou attitude that you might show people.
Mm-mm.
That chases people away from religion as well. You know, you don't want to show that and so on. So this is one of the advice that I was given for one of my teachers. Again, may Allah bless him.
That's awesome.
So, like, and he always mentioned this. Fine. He says, keep religion to the religious venues. For example, you speak Jum'ah,
go
on the mimbar, you talk in Haram or in Shah Ramadan, and then, you know, that's the place for your religious discussion.
Yes.
But what if they come to that, that's different.
Yeah.
But outside, like in family gathering, let's talk about something else. And don't have to bring up religion at all.
That was really interesting. Thank you for sharing that with me. Brother, how many times in your life did you feel like I need to negotiate my way out of this?
I think it's, you know, starts from my home.
Guys, but where do you live?
But you know, hear me out first of all.
Okay.
You know, negotiation. What is the definition of negotiation?
Yeah,
you know,
good question.
If we are negotiating, are we fighting? Are we arguing, or are we reaching to a logical conclusion? That's the main idea. You know, a negotiation is basically to. You know, talk through reasoning and then reach to the, you know, right conclusion.
That will benefit both parties.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, there are sometimes, you know, my wife wants to do something or sometimes I want to do something, and then we discuss each other and then try to reach the conclusion that it's possible or not. Can we do that or not? And then, alhamdulillah, you know, when we talk to each other, we reach to a right conclusion that, you know, this is feasible right now or this is not feasible. It happens the same thing with children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my kid was asking, for example, like for the last 2 years to buy a bicycle. And
don't you just love negotiating with children?
Yeah, of course.
This is a true story. I'm so sorry. This is just for comical relief. Her father asked her. She wanted a top bunk. She wanted like double bunk bed, right? And her father asked her, well, her father told her, you sleep in your own bed for 10 nights. I'm going to get you a double 4 nights pass. And her daddy is like, baby, why aren't you sleeping in your bed? I'm not making this up. She was like, well, dad, I haven't had time yet. This child will go to places. She hasn't had time to sleep in her bed yet. Please.
Yeah,
proceed to tell me your story of negotiating with your children, because that always works.
So this was just the one example. Like one day he asked me, you know, Baba, how can we prove the existence of God,
oh,
for example, you know. So, I mean, these are different levels of negotiations, you know. You do right from your home, they start right from your home, and you don't even realize that you're negotiating. And for the students of seminary, I think it's an ideal situation. We have to do that for the rest of our lives,
yeah,
when we go to Pakistan or anywhere else for the tabligh and even for the preaching. So I remember that when I was working for a cellular company in the States,
mm-hmm,
it was very competitive. Like, they had 5 or 6 different cellular networks, and unfortunately, our company, which is a franchise company, mm-hmm, they put all those franchise companies in the one store.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was offering all 5 different companies.
Right. That
and
must
I was
have been
I
hard.
Was selling all of those companies, for example, the services and the cell phone products and everything. So it was really hard for me to talk to the customers, because I had to learn about 5 cellular networks, their products, their services, and then the questions which were being posed, you know, to me, that, you know, this is what is good thing about this network, what is bad thing about other network, and this and that. So negotiation, I think it's again, you know, we need to define that what is negotiation. Sometimes there is negotiation which is peaceful,
mm,
you know, reaching to the right conclusion, and sometimes there is negotiation which leads to no result. So, mm, I think the one negotiation which leads to no result, I think it's a bad one.
The Quran says that jadal ahsan.
Yeah, exactly.
Jadal,
what does that
mean? Means that you just it's a debate discussion, mm, but it must be ahsan. It must reach
way.
A good conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that that person has to accept what you say, but as long as it is respectful, as long as, for example,
and there's acknowledgement.
Like, for example, fine, I agree with what you say, but I still have my reservations, for example.
Yeah.
Or the other person says, fine, you know,
I acknowledge that you think this way,
but don't force your idea on me, for example. That's fine. That's what the Quran says, especially
yeah.
when it comes to like jadal ahsan and so on.
Have you ever been in a situation where you had to debate, discuss, or negotiate, and you felt like, all right, this person with whom I'm negotiating is attacking me on a personal level now, right? How do you retaliate, or do you retaliate at all? How do you deal with that situation?
It's happened a few times, especially on religious discussions.
Right.
Because obviously religion beliefs is something very personal to somebody.
Mm.
If, for example, a person, a personal attack first of all shows the weakness of the other side.
Right.
It shows you don't have the academic or the intellectual capacity to actually debate.
Mm.
It's a weakness. It's straight up, because what we call in logic, it's a logical fallacy.
Right.
Because you're not now presenting an argument. You are
right.
directly attacking the person who's bringing the argument.
Exactly.
Just in order to kind of show people around you and to take their attention away
mm.
from the actual matter.
And to force yourself the upper hand.
Exactly. And not only that, it's also to bring out a reaction from the opposite
mm.
side. So at times when that happened, there's also we have the clear Quranic ayah of when someone does that, قُلُوا salama. Say, salamu alayhi person,
mm.
greet him and leave. Because you know immediately that person has no good intention.
Dead end, khalas.
There's no intention there.
Right.
You know, there are sometimes you don't discuss. I give you a personal example, the demise of Hazrat Abu Talib alayhi salam.
Yeah.
So there was a group of individuals who, there's a majority of Muslims believe that this individual was passed away as a non-Muslim and so on and so forth, na'udhu billah. So I know the argument, and I know that because of the belief in a certain argument, these people will not veer from this belief.
Uh-huh.
But obviously they asked, and we have to take, what is your belief? I said, look, I know you're not going to change your view or your stance and so on. So what we'll do is we did like a Holy Prophet did a semi-mubahila.
Right.
A mubahila is a thing when you come and you don't discuss anymore because
mm-hmm.
there's no point for discussion. That was what mubahila was. Mubahila was a time where fine, we've reached a dead end in our discussions. Right. I'm not going to prove anything to you. You're not going to prove anything to me. If we are right, fine. If you are right,
we're done.
We're done.
Okay.
Whatever.
Also
whatever, right? No, we don't want to go into those. So I had a semi-mubahila, right, with these mm. people. I said, fine. We make a dua, me and you.
Mm.
We make a dua. Whoever else wants to wish to join, bismillah. I said,
I pray that on the day of judgment, wherever Abu Talib alayhi salam is, I will be with him.
Ya Allah.
And you pray, wherever he is, you'll be on the opposite side.
Perfect.
That's what I said. And you say, Ameen. And we leave it to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the day of judgment. A few accepted, a few rejected outright. Mm. So we will not do this. But some did.
Wow.
So this was like, this is where you reach the stage, like,
exactly.
There's no point for discuss anymore.
Right.
And in history, after the obviously the main in Holy Quran with the Christians of Najran, there were certain companions of the Imams who were given permission specifically to do this to a group of people who you could just not speak to them.
Right, but it was still important to prove right from wrong.
Exactly. So because of the other people around, because not only because if that person, for example, when the Mubahila comes and Azab comes, you will see that, okay, that person obviously is wrong, and that person
right.
is right. So it's also for
the
other
people
around
and
as
for
well.
History, really.
Exactly. So we have Mubahila and so on in that. So this is going in the Islam. So you have Jadal, and you have Jadal Ahsan.
That is so hardcore, though. Mubahila. You know, like, okay, so I can't get you to agree with me. See you on Judgment Day, man. I'm so sure of... But that's so beautiful for you to have certainty to that extent regarding your belief system and your worldview, and to be so sure about your arguments regarding your ideology.
I'll
to
try
a
that
point.
As well.
Inshallah.
Yeah, exactly.
And it works for, it's not only this, for example, like I had a teacher who did the same thing. Again, they were discussing with an alim who was not Shia. And he said, fine, you know. As I pray by the right of Muhammad Ali, Fatima Hassan Hussein, you pray by the right of those people. So this person says, why are you asking by those people? Why are you praying for those people? Also pray for me with those people. They said, but why?
People constantly making things complicated. When was the last time, bro, that you reached a dead end in a negotiation? And how did you find yourself out of it?
Well, again, you know, subcontinent. You know, we have the issue of a generation gap, big time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just a very close example, you know, maybe sometimes I and my father, we cannot agree on things. So, you know, there are many instances and examples, you know, we are talking out of logic and reasoning, and they're not listening at all.
Exactly.
So, I mean, this is a dead end.
You can't do mobile at that.
And you can't. They've disarmed you in every way. You're like, you know what? Do I go to hell or do I go to hell? What am I supposed to do now?
Exactly. So this is a dead end. And I think here, the only thing you can do is you offer a namaz-e-shab and pray for that. You know, that's the only solution you have. I mean, there's nothing
exactly.
else you can do.
And this is a form of ihsan. The Quran tells you, the Quran doesn't tell you to agree with your parents. It doesn't tell you to obey them in a lot of circumstances and situations. It doesn't even tell you to think the way they think, even though they raised you and they formed your thought. It tells you to do ihsan. And sometimes the greatest form of kindness toward our parents is like, Dad, I know you're wrong. I can't prove you're wrong, but I can pray for you. How about that?
Exactly.
And don't tell them that you prayed for them either, because that is going to get you in trouble too. I think that's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, I'm very happy to be again with you with our second episode in our program, which is called Month of Allah. And I'll be continuing to explain about the Ahkam, specifically about this holy month. Previously, I talked about the intention in fasting, which is really important. But right now, I'm going to start with the first thing that we need to really care about, we need to regard, and that's not eating and not drinking, which is regarded as those kind of activities that break your fasting. It is really popular, you know, if you ask anybody about fasting, they know that eating and drinking is forbidden in that period of time. But there are a couple of specific things and details about this matter of eating and drinking that need to be said. The important thing is anything which is regarded normally and regularly by the people that they eat or drink, you should not have that. Or things that are not regularly eaten, like dust, like soil, like anything. If it comes to the, you know, area of your mouth, and if you swallow it, it breaks your fasting. So the first point, which is important, is anything that is regularly eaten or irregularly, it's not important. All of it just breaks your fast. The second thing is that period of fasting, you know, from Adhan to Adhan, a couple of hours, you need to have your fast on. The important thing is a couple of minutes before the Adhan of the morning and a couple of minutes after the Adhan of the Maghrib, we need to stop eating and drinking, and after that we can start. Why? Because we need to be sure, this is one of the important ahkam, we need to be sure that in this period, all of this period, we have not eaten and we have not drunk anything. To be sure, we need to stop doing that and prevent ourselves from eating and drinking a couple of minutes before and a couple of minutes after. The second thing is sometimes, you know, it happens to people that, you know, unintentionally, they just do something. For example, the morning has started, the Adhan has started, but a person is continuing to eat. And at that, you know, moment, suddenly he understands that, he or she understands that, okay, Adhan has started. If that moment happens for you, you need to take out that piece of food in your mouth or anything that you are eating. You need to take it out, for example, after that, wash your hand, and start your fasting, because it has happened unintentionally. You have not been aware of that. You have not been aware of the fact that Adhan has started. But if you are aware, then your fast is not validated. It's in Arabic, like in the language of Din, we say it's batil. It's not validated, so it breaks it. The third thing, which is really important, and happens so much for the people, is that the fact that after eating something, some parts of that remains, you know, lodged between our teeth or on your gum, for example, or some part of your mouth, and it, you know, drives some people to obsession. The fact that they need to wash their mouths so much, or pick a, you know, toothpick and try to take all of those little pieces of, you know, food in your mouth out. It's not necessary, it's not obligatory to, you know, put every piece of food between your mouth or in your, you know, on your gum, between your teeth, out of your mouth. It's not necessary to do that, It's not obligatory. But if somebody is sure that if doesn't, you don't use, you know, the toothbrush, if you don't use the toothpick, that amount of food is going to come down your mouth and you're going to, it's going to happen, you're going to swallow it, then you need to absolutely wash your mouth, you need to absolutely use your toothbrush. But otherwise, no, it's not necessary, because a lot of times it happens that those little pieces of, you know, food between your teeth, it just stays there up to the Adhan of Maghrib. And after that, you break your fast, it's normal. So don't let it, you know, get you into the obsession area, which is really bothering. Thank you very much, and be with us. We're going to continue.
In the limelight.
Human rights defenders have expressed concern after the Biden administration announced it reached agreements with Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala for those countries to boost their deployments of military forces to stop the flow of immigrants trying to make their way to the United States. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading Rights Advocates Concerned Over Biden Push to Increase Militarization of Borders in Central America. Here's more on this issue. Human rights defenders have recently expressed concern after the Biden administration announced it reached agreements with Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala for those countries to boost their deployments of military forces to stop the flow of immigrants trying to make their way to the United States. I think the objective is to make it more difficult to make the journey and make crossing the borders more difficult, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said recently. Psaki said that under the agreements, which were reached over recent weeks, Mexico will keep 10,000 troops at its southern border. Guatemala upped its number of police and military personnel to its southern border with Honduras to 1,500 and will put up 12 checkpoints along the country's migratory route, he said, while Honduras surged 7,000 police and military to disperse a large contingent of migrants. Tyler Moran, Special Assistant to the President for Immigration for Domestic Policy Council, also spoke about the agreements in an interview with MSNBC. We've secured agreements for them to put more troops on their own border. Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala have all agreed to do this. That not only is going to prevent the traffickers and the smugglers and cartels that take advantage of the kids on their way here, but also to protect those children, Moran said. Dylan Corbett, executive director of the Hope Border Institute, disputed that characterization of the agreements. While ostensibly a measure against smugglers, traffickers, and cartels, this is exactly the thing. That generates more smuggling, trafficking, and cartel exploitation, and the most vulnerable will feel the brunt, tweeted Corbett, who called the development so disappointing. The other day, I met an asylum-seeking mom from Guatemala who was assaulted by the Mexican military as she and children tried to cross the border in El Paso, he added. In the mayhem, kids got to the other side and were processed as unaccompanied minors. She hasn't seen them since December. Erika Guevara Rosas, the Americas director at Amnesty International, accused Biden of repeating the mistakes of past administrations by securing agreements with Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras to further militarize their borders in a bid to stop people who are fleeing from state repression, violent crime, food insecurity, and the devastating effects of the climate crisis. Instead of deploying more troops, governments in the region must respect and uphold people's rights to seek asylum and live in safety, she said. The agreements to further militarize international borders in the region also drew criticism from Clara Long, associate director with the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, who tweeted that they seem to focus on deterrence rather than protection. A focus on deterrence and the coercion of other governments to collaborate with the United States on harsh measures, said Long, was a major feature of the Trump administration's policies. She called it particularly worrying that the agreements seem to focus on the continued and increased deployment of security forces with problematic human rights records. The Biden administration should place human rights at the center of its migration discussions and agreements with regional governments, Long said. The agreement comes as the United States of America saw a record number of unaccompanied children attempting to cross the border in March, and the largest number of Border Patrol encounters overall with migrants on the southern border, just under 170,000 since March 2001. According to White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, Mexico will maintain a deployment of about 10,000 troops, while Guatemala has sent 1,500 police and military personnel to its southern border, and Honduras deployed 7,000 police and military to its border to disperse a large contingent of migrants there. Guatemala will also set up 12 checkpoints along the migratory route through the country.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amoli. Stay tuned.
شیطان الرجیم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. رخداد تلخی که اخیراً جامعه بشری را
I seek refuge with Allah from Satan, the outcast. In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful. The bitter events which have lately engulfed humanity, that is the uninvited coronavirus disease, is in accordance with the absolute mercy of Allah.
دعاها این جمله در بخشای پایانی این کتاب شریف مفاتیح است که یا من سهود و
There's a famous dua at the end of the precious book مفاتیح الجنان which says Oh, the one whose name is a medicine and whose resemblance is a cure. These two statements are famous. This following third statement is very rational, logical, and measured. Oh, the one whose name is a medicine and whose resemblance is cure. Oh, the one who places cure or remedy within things based upon what you want. Oh, Allah, in anything that you want, you place a cure and remedy. Your power of knowledge is unlimited. Your will is unlimited. Even before you say anything, the universe obeys you. Thus, it is by your will, needless of your words, that you are obeyed. The whole of existence obeys you as you will. It isn't necessary for you to speak. This is Allah. Therefore, we find that dua plays a decisive role, especially when you are addressing Allah.
امیدواریم ذات اقدس اله نزاع ما را جامعه ما را مخصوصا بزرگوار و بزرگان پزشکی ما را که در خط مقدم
We are hopeful that the exalted being of Allah protects our Islamic system, our society, and especially the greatly esteemed physicians who are on the front line of this danger, protects them from all harms and removes this disease and virus from humanity. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.